He was a lawyer. He was also a very, very wealthy real estate tycoon in the mid-1800s. His family was a well-known prominent family in Chicago in the 1860s. He had five children. He had heavily invested in lots of property. But there's this thing that happened in 1871 in Chicago. Does anyone know what happened that year? A large fire. It destroyed most of the city and almost all of Horatio's property. Thing about that, though, is that probably wasn't first on his mind because a short time before the fire, his son died. So his son dies, and then I think it's about a week later, almost all of his property and his estate and everything like that burns. And so he decides, okay, we need a break. We need to get away from here for right now. He had four other children. He had four daughters. And so they decide, they're also friends with Dwight L. Moody. You may have heard that name before. The evangelist of that time period. He was good friends with him. He was a very major financial contributor to Moody. And so Moody invited them to come with him on one of revival overseas in Europe. And so they're all getting on the boat, and something came up, an opportunity came up for Horatio to get some of the finances back that were lost in the fire. And so he had to stop and send his family with him, said, I'll meet you in a few days. You go on ahead of me. There's this thing to take care of. And which makes sense because his estate had all just burned down. So as his family's sailing across the ocean, though, there is a major shipwreck. And his four children all drown. His remaining four of the five children. His wife survives. He doesn't know this yet, though, because this was actually a major shipwreck. Communication wasn't all that common then. So he learns the shipwreck happened first. A couple days later, he gets a telegram from his wife that said, only survivor. And so now this man, who is a good man, as far as we know from that time period, he was a major contributor of an evangelist. He did lots of good things. He was a prominent family in Chicago. He had all sorts of things going for him. And then just like a story from Job, right? One of his children dies, then all of his property is destroyed, and then the rest of his children die. And so the question is, why do things like that happen to people like that? That's the question on our minds sometimes on this life, because the world is not always a good place, is it? And that's the question of today's minor prophet that we're looking at. We are going through the 12 minor prophets, those 12 little books at the end of the Old Testament. All of them are their own independent sets of prophecy, sets of stories, or prophecies to tell. And this one has to do with that subject of why do bad things happen to good people and why do good things happen to bad people? That second question is more of the question that Habakkuk will be in the book of Habakkuk today. That Habakkuk asks is why do good things happen to bad people? Why does God seem to reward evil people? That's more of the question Habakkuk asks, but the inverse question is on our minds just as often of why do bad things happen to good people? You might notice that this book has a little bit of overlap in theme with last book. Last week's theme was why is God not stopping this evil nation because they're evil? Why is God choosing to bless them? And so similar, except that was at a whole national scale. This prophet is more of individual here, of individual things. There's a little bit of a national scale in it, but this is much more along the lines of generic what is called theodicy. Have you heard the word theodicy before? It is a theological word, theos dike. Theos, God, DK, righteousness, or not righteousness, justice of God. So God's justice. Why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? Why does God allow good things to happen to bad people? How long is God going to allow suffering? That's the sort of question that is asked when you're talking about theodicy. And the book of Habakkuk has a lot to do with that. The book of Job also has a lot to do with that, right? But this is from a prophet's perspective instead of Job here. And he asks, basically, why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? And so Habakkuk is this debate around theodicy. And in fact, he starts off his book by yelling at God. How many of you have ever taken time to yell at God before? You probably don't want to raise your hand in church to tell people you have, do you? If you have. But if you have, you're actually right in line with like a lot of the Bible. Do you know a third of our Psalms are yelling at God? A third of them. And the Psalms are the songbook of God's people. And a third of them are upset at God. But that makes sense, though, because when you have a problem with someone else, who are you supposed to talk to about it? Everyone else or that person? If you go to everyone else, you're a terrible person. You should go directly to the source, right? And if you think God has a problem with you, who should you go talk to about it? If you have a problem with God, who should you go talk to about it? God. And the scriptures actually give us that example quite often. Several books, the book of Lamentations, the entire thing is a lament, which is wailing and crying to God because everything's terrible. The third of the Psalms, as I said, are complaining to God because everything seems terrible. Now, a lot of those third of the Psalms, they by the end of the Psalm, they get calmed down, and Habakkuk's sort of that way too. Habakkuk starts with this line against God here. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1 will be here. The first line is the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. So, okay, it's the introduction. That's the title of the book. Here's what it says. It says, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you, violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, and so justice goes forth perverted. Have you ever prayed to God like that? God, why is it so messed up on this earth? Do you not seriously care, God? That's what Habakkuk prays, and that's okay to pray. Who's the only one big enough to take complaints like that? God? Is God ever wounded by us being honest with him? In fact, what does he like less? Us being dishonest with him, right? And so if like you feel like your life's terrible, and you pray, oh God, thank you for everything, and the sunshine is just so nice. Is that a real prayer or a fake prayer? God doesn't like fake prayers, right? And so it's okay if life stinks at some moment to tell God that life stinks. That's not the main lesson of Habakkuk, but that's the nice bonus lesson we get, that it's okay. God can handle that. God is never threatened by honest questions to him, and he's the one you actually should be bringing those honest questions to. He's the one you should discuss those things with. There's nothing wrong with asking God, why? Why me? Why does my life hurt? Why does this person I love's life hurt? Why doesn't this make sense? It's okay to ask him those questions. It really is. What is wrong, though, is when you attack God because of it and say you're terrible because of this. That's wrong. I'll admit that's taking it too far, but saying why is this happening? There's nothing wrong with that. God is not threatened by those sorts of things, like asking seriously, God, how long do I cry out without an answer? That's okay to pray. We have that example several times in the Bible, praying something like that. Unfortunately, though, when we ask those sorts of questions, the answer we usually get is not an answer, right? Why do bad things happen to good people? I don't know. Why do good things happen to bad people? I don't know. How long do we have to wait and suffer? I don't know. Those are the answers the Bible actually gives us, because I don't know. Looking at the book of Job, for example, book of Job is the clear-cut case for someone's life who's terrible, and God actually shows up, and when Job asks him the question, finally, what does God answer Job with? Does he answer him with, oh yeah, this is why I did it? Does he get that? No, actually what he gets at the end of the book is, you don't have the right to ask that question. I'm God. That's how Job gets answered at the end. You don't have the right to demand something of God. That's how the book ends, because God owns everything. He's in charge of everything. He's just awesome. That's the end of the book of Job. Job, unfortunately, doesn't get the first two chapters of the book that gives us the reason why Job loses everything. Job doesn't have that. Job doesn't get the heavenly perspective. He just gets the, oh, my life's terrible perspective. Here. But going back to Habakkuk, it's hard to talk about Habakkuk without going to Job, though. We see that Habakkuk's sort of a different one because God, in the case of the book of Habakkuk, actually does show up and answer Habakkuk. Habakkuk asks, why are evil people being blessed? And God shows up and says, here's why. That actually happens in the book of Habakkuk, and the answer helps Habakkuk out because at the end, the very last book of it, the very last verse of the book is verse chapter 3:19. It says, God, the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places to the choir master with stringed instruments. So that last line is very obviously a musical line. So there's three chapters in the book of Habakkuk. Chapters 1 and 2 are a conversation between Habakkuk and God. Chapter 3 is a song that Habakkuk writes because of the conversation he had with God. So Habakkuk's actually probably one of the earliest worship leaders we had. What's especially funny is that's what you get in ESV. In the Hebrew, it actually says, with my stringed instruments. So a loose translation of this very last line of the book is, to the choir master, I'm going to play my own guitar. I just think that's hilarious, that line is actually in the scriptures. But everyone's straight-faced here. It's a serious book. You have to laugh sometimes, right? Anyways, I'll play with my guitar. You can play with yours. Don't touch my instruments. That's what's in there, sort of. Okay, so going back to the beginning of the book, let's look at God's answer for Habakkuk. It starts in chapter 1, verse 5. So Habakkuk starts with, why is there all this injustice? Why are you not caring? And here's what God says, verses 5 through 7. It says, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. And so Habakkuk says, God, why aren't you paying attention? Evil is winning and good is at a loss. And God answers with, pay attention. Evil's not winning. In fact, I'm raising up this nation over here to take care of evil. They're going to be my arm in this case. He talks about the Chaldeans taking up arms and how they're going to bring justice. Now, this is sort of the only historical footnote in the book. The rest is just sort of very vague terms. Some of your translations, instead of Chaldeans, if you're reading through like the NIV, it says Babylonians. That is an interpretation, not a translation. Because the Chaldeans are not Babylonians, but they are a part of the Babylonian dynasty. They are a Babylonian dynasty that gets raised up. They suddenly come to international power. They kill the Assyrians, which is that nation that we've talked about for a while, those really, really, really bad, evil guys. They take over, conquer the Assyrians. They live for about 100 years long, which is just long enough to conquer the Assyrians and then have the Israelites for 70 years of captivity. And then the Chaldean dynasty is gone and never really seen again on the face of the earth. It's almost like God raised up a nation to do a specific task, and then he was done with that nation, and they did the task that God called them for, and then he was done. It's almost like that, which is kind of what scriptures say happened. I think it's neat that historically that bears true, is that this dynasty rose to international power and then was gone after a few generations. You know, long enough for them to come into power and have 70 years of captivity and then go away, which is what took place. But, so that is probably in the background of Habakkuk's thinking, is evil's winning, because there's this really evil nation out there, and the answer God gives is, Habakkuk, you think I'm not paying attention? I am. Here's one example. I'm currently in control of the nations, and I'm going to handle the Assyrians by using the Chaldeans to overthrow them. The next several verses of Habakkuk chapter 1 talk about the strength that the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, have. He talks about how great of power they have, and how they're going to come in and sweep through and win everything. And one might think that'd be really cool to receive an answer from God, right? Like, who here, if you did ever pray that sort of prayer of, God, how long do we have to wait? And God says to you directly, I've got this handled, just wait a little bit. This context right here is going on. These guys are going to do it. They're going to save the day. It's going to be all great. How would you feel if that ever happened? Like, if God directly answered you and says, I've got it handled, I'm taking care of it. Would that be nice? Would you probably be in, like, awe of how great God is? And that's not what Habakkuk does. Habakkuk complains to God again. So here's the verse, verse 12 through 13. As soon as God finishes his answer, the next verse is this. Habakkuk says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? So Habakkuk says, that sounds nice, God, but did you forget that the Chaldeans, they're pagans too? Did you forget about that? They're also an evil nation. So why are you raising them up and giving them power? Because they're also evil, and if evil conquers evil, evil's still in charge. So did you not get my question, God? I'm still wondering why evil wins. Why do evil things get blessed? I asked whether or not you care about bad things happening, and all you told me is that evil's going to win. That's Habakkuk's response. So he really picks some holes in the argument there against God, and Habakkuk actually goes on with that line of questioning for the rest of the chapter there. It ends with the first verse of chapter 2 when Habakkuk literally says, I've asked you my question, I take my stand, I'm going to wait for you. It says, I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. So as if the miracle of God showing up to answer him in the first case wasn't cool enough, he then nitpicks the answer that God gave him, says, that wasn't really a good answer, God. And so you know what? Here I stand. I'm going to sit in my watchtower and wait for you to answer. Now that's probably pushing it too far. Like, it really is. Okay, scriptures tell us it's okay to ask God questions. It's okay to bring God your honest things. But to get an answer from God and then say, you know what, that wasn't good enough? I'm going to sit here and wait. I need another answer. Come on, God. I'm not moving. How many of you would be willing to do that? Hopefully none of you. But that's what Habakkuk does here in chapter 2, verse 1. And God is really nice to Habakkuk because he answers again. The rest of chapter 2 is God's answer. So almost the entire section of chapter 2. It says here in verse 2 through 5, I'll read the first part of the answer. It says, and the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets that he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he is never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own all peoples. So he starts us off with, you know, I guess you didn't hear me the first time, so go ahead and write down my answer this time. I think that God's kind of pushing back there a little bit. He's saying, go write this down. You might forget. So go ahead and take note here, Habakkuk. If I seem slow, wait. What kind of an answer is that? That's really what he says there. He says, looking at this, if it seems slow, wait for it. If it's taken a while, get some patience. That's God's answer here. Just keep waiting here. And then he says, though, that the righteous will live by faith. And then he goes on to say, and here's the next thing, wine is a traitor. Now that seems out of the blue. Wine is a traitor. What does that have to do with suffering and things like that? I think you could take it in the perspective, okay, wine actually doesn't solve your problems. It does for about, you know, a couple hours, and then it makes it worse after that, right? So wine is a traitor. But the other way to look at it, and I think this is the better way to look at it, although that way is kind of true too, that doesn't fix your problems on this earth, is that if God really wanted to satisfy your thirst for answers, that would taste like wine, wouldn't it? But it wouldn't work. It will never satisfy. The next line says it's this problem, these needs, these pains are as deep as Sheol, as the grave, as deep as death. You could be asking God questions of why bad things happen all your life long, and he could honestly give you answers all your life long, and you will still have questions at the end. If God wanted to satisfy your thirst for that, it would not satisfy the cravings, because those are human questions, not divine questions. And we will never run out of them. God's answers to human questions do not satisfy. Even though they're God's answers, they're not the right question. And so they won't be satisfied. And goes on to say, an arrogant man is a man who demands all the answers. He says everything is his. He needs to be satisfied. And God goes, no, you don't. If you think you're waiting for an answer, keep waiting. The righteous will live by faith instead. And so God finishes the rest of chapter 2. I won't read through it all, but God finishes the rest of chapter 2 by stating not how there's good and evil and why there's evil and why he lets some of it happen and things like that. Instead, God just states that he'll handle it. There's a series of woe statements. If you remember what woe statements are when a judge hands down the death penalty to someone. That is a woe. And so God, the ultimate judge, is handing down death penalties to evil. And he lists off several evils and says, yeah, that evil, it's got a death penalty on it. This evil, it has a death penalty on it. This bad thing, yes, it has a death penalty on it. I will handle these things. That's God's answer. He doesn't answer why, he just says, I've got this. Calm down, Habakkuk. Everything is on the world's gonna roll from a divine perspective. But the question for us often, though, is, okay, that's neat. Yeah, we know the world's going to end and God's going to do heaven and things like that, but why now and how long? And what's the answer to how long and when that God gives in the verses we've already read? Is keep waiting. That's the answer we get. That's the answer that God provides. here. When will he handle it and put an end to all the pain and suffering? Verse 3, it's, if it seems slow, wait for it. But verse 4, though, that's the important one where it says, the righteous shall live by his faith. Have you heard that phrase before, the righteous shall live by faith? If you read through the New Testament, then you'll hear it at least three times. It's one of the favorite verses of the New Testament, one of the favorite Old Testament verses. And so it's used in Galatians, it's used in Romans, it's used in Hebrews. So because that is, I think it's the most important verse of the entire book of Habakkuk. And some of the other New Testament writers single it out too. And so let's look at one of the other New Testament writers. Mostly Paul talks about this. Paul in Galatians 3, he writes this and quotes from Habakkuk. He says, "For all who rely on the works of the law are under a curse. For it is written, 'Cursed be anyone who does not abide by all things written in the book of the law and do them.' Now it is evident that no one is justified before God by the law, for the righteous shall live by faith. But the law is not of faith. Rather, the one who does them shall live by them. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree.' So that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith." So Paul here in Galatians says the righteous shall live by faith is the heart of the gospel. We don't live by rules, we live by faith in a God who is willing to take up our curse because we could not follow all of the rules. And so he takes that, he dies on a tree, accepts that curse of dying on a tree, the cross, and he lets us be saved through our faith in that and we receive God's Spirit. We live by that faith and it becomes righteousness. So there's the gospel, right? But that righteous shall live by faith, though, the gospel is not really the context of Habakkuk. So let's look at another passage when it's quoted in the book of Romans. Here's Romans chapter 1, and that same verse gets quoted by Paul again. But in Romans, he says, "So I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, 'The righteous shall live by faith.'" The righteous shall live by faith. Paul writes, as he wrote to Galatians, as part of this gospel for us to become saved. But it's not just for those who want to be saved, because Paul here writes, "I am eager to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome." Who are the people in Rome that he's writing this letter to? Who are the recipients that receive this letter? Are they not Christians or are they Christians yet? They're Christians, right? If you doubt that, just go back a few verses and he makes it very clear that he's preaching to the saints in Rome, that he's preaching to the people in Rome who already believe the gospel, and yet he says, "I am anxious, I'm eagerly excited to go preach the gospel to you." Why is Paul excited to preach the gospel to people who believe the gospel? Why is that helpful? Now, one guess in first service is that maybe it's because they don't understand the gospel. That could be part of it, but the book of Romans is actually the only book in like the whole New Testament where Paul doesn't say you guys are wrong. He just explains the gospel in the book of Romans. He doesn't outright state they're completely wrong about everything like he does in several of the other books and says you guys really don't understand what's going on. He doesn't do that in the book of Romans. He just says, "I want to go share the gospel with you, you who already believe the gospel." So why is it important that Christians receive the gospel again? Yes, to correct errors, that genuinely is part of it. But he doesn't point out any real errors that they have to the church in Rome. Let's look at the third quotation from the New Testament of this verse, "The righteous shall live by faith." Hebrews chapter 10, verse 32 through 39, it says, "But recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those who were so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls." There again, it's quoted. He mixes two quotes, and so if you're confused there, he also quotes from Isaiah. And without saying he's switching, he starts quoting from Habakkuk here. So he mixes quotes. But that "the righteous shall live by faith" is there in that? And what's the context in Hebrews? Why does he use this verse, the righteous shall live by faith? What do you talk about in the preceding paragraph there? I'll point out a couple things from the paragraph. Again, it's, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, being exposed to reproach, being partners with those who are treated, those in prison, joyfully accepting the plundering of your own property, which means people are stealing from them because they're Christians. That's the context of him bringing up the righteous shall live by faith here. It's suffering. These Christians were persecuted and terrorized and stolen from. So the righteous will live by faith. Is that a similar context to Habakkuk? Suffering, and so the righteous shall live by faith. There's evil, so the righteous shall live by faith. And so what does this have to do with the gospel? How does this work together? Well, first, let me ask, is that a similar context to maybe some of our prayers? Suffering? I mean, we don't get that much suffering for being Christian here. We might think there's some, and there's occasionally court cases about it for taking stands on faith. But we know lots of brothers throughout the world who are suffering, and we also know that not just suffering for the gospel, suffering in general is part of this life. Hurts and pains. And we might ask questions of God, but what would, perhaps, if that's the answer for suffering about evil nations, if that's the answer for suffering persecution as Christians, maybe it's also the answer for just suffering in general, and the answer would be the righteous shall live by faith. And the righteous shall live by faith is, as Paul writes, is the heart of the gospel. And so how does the gospel address our suffering here on this earth? How does the gospel address the, why is there evil? How long do we have to wait? How long will God bless evil things, and how long will God take care of bad things, or not take care of bad things? And the answer is, hold on, don't give up. If it seems like you're waiting, wait a little longer. The righteous shall live by faith. Live is present. It means keep living by faith. Don't stop living by faith. Don't give up faith in the face of trials and temptations and hurts. The righteous will hold on to God, even though it sometimes looks stupid to do so. That's what the righteous person will do. They will hold on to faith, even if it seems like there's a leap of faith going on. Because God will handle the problems, and that does not make the problems go away. They don't suddenly stop. In fact, Jesus actually says the more faith you have, the more you're going to get persecuted, right? And Jesus says it's going to get worse before it gets better there. And so the problems are as deep as the grave, and if we look for answers there, you can answer some problems, right? You can point out, yeah, that problem exists because of this problem. That problem exists because of this really bad choice. But it doesn't work universally, and there are a whole lot of problems that still have no answers for. And so the problems don't go away. The problems are deep at the grave. The problems, the answers would never satisfy the problems anyway. Like someone's death doesn't get solved if you know why they died, right? The answers are not what helps of why there is death and suffering in this world. And so what do you do instead? You focus on the gospel, because the righteous shall live by faith in the gospel. And a life of faith holding on to that promise. Because here's the gospel, Jesus makes all things new. That's why Christians need it just as much as non-Christians. It's because Christians experience suffering just as much as non-Christians. Because we all live on the same planet Earth. We all live in the same cursed world. We all have the same loved ones even sometimes. Life on this earth hurts, and so what we do is we focus on the gospel because God is a God who redeems things. Can God redeem suffering? If not, then what's up with the cross, right? That's suffering. Jesus suffered. He took on the curse for the entire world. He died and rose again. That's pretty strong redemption of suffering, if you ask me, right? Can God redeem broken things and make them better? If not, then what are we doing gathered here in this place, right? What in the world are Christians doing if we don't believe that God can redeem our sinful lives and make them better, and that as we profess faith in him, we get buried into the water and come up newness of life, new creations, and we follow after him? If God can't redeem us, then what are we doing gathered here? We do believe that, right? That's the gospel. And so even when we believe the gospel about how we became Christian, we should keep believing the gospel about everything else, that God is in the business of redeeming things. And that's throughout the universe, isn't it? Just all sorts of things. He takes night and turns it into what? He takes winter where there's no life and there's death and the trees don't have leaves, and just a few months later, what does he do with it all? How does a seed turn into a plant? What does it first have to do? Get broken apart and shoved into the dirt and get waterboarded, right? How does a muscle get bigger and stronger? God is in the business of redeeming things, and it is woven throughout all of creation. Even though this world is pretty bent and broken and really messed up and terrible to live in, God is so redemptive that this world is also really amazing and awesome to live in, right? And even though there's hurts and problems and pains, would you trade all of that for like getting to experience love and knowing God and knowing that he cares for you? And this world is actually a great place, even though it's a terrible place. And both are true. Why? Because of the gospel. God redeems things. God takes hurting things and makes them better. God takes bent things and makes them straight. God takes broken things and repairs them, and they're just nice now, and God can take care of all of these things. God's redemptive ways are all around us, and that's the gospel. We need the gospel to become Christians. That's amazing redemption, but even Christians can't forget the gospel and continue to live by faith, because we have faith that even when the world is terrible, the world can be pretty good, and that God will one day redeem it all for good. Just don't stop living by faith, the faith that God has it all handled. And we're going to ask why. That's normal. It's okay to ask God why. But when we ask God why, what that should lead us to instead is to start asking a different question. Instead, that question should be who. When life is hurting, instead of saying, why me, why my loved one, why this pain, why this hurt, why this suffering, why this disease, why this death, should be, who should I look to when there's this problem? Who is the one who is big enough to actually handle this problem? Who is the only one who can actually redeem terribly broken things? Who is the one that can actually take care of sinful things and lost things? That's God. That's the one who can do all of these things. There's only one answer to that question, and Habakkuk finishes with these verses. Chapter 3, verse 17 through 19 says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, they produce the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls. That's not a very good situation, is it? There's no food, there's no water, there's no flock, there's no olive oil, there's no nothing. All of our trees are dead. Even though all of this stuff's crazy is happening, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Even though there's nothing good left and it seems silly to do so, I'm going to worship God anyway because he's the only one who can actually keep my feet on sure ground. And so the righteous will live by faith. I will have faith that God can make me righteous. And if I know God can make me righteous, I know that he can redeem anything. And he can redeem even these terrible situations that I'm surrounded in. And the problems don't go away, but I know that they will eventually. And if you're stuck waiting, it's okay to wait. Patience is not a terrible thing. And we wait for those words that Jesus spoke on the cross to be fully fulfilled, that it is finished. That's what we wait for. Those last couple verses of Habakkuk are very similar to words of a song that you might know. The reveal that I mentioned before about this Horatio guy who lost all five children in 1871, he went on while he was sailing across the ocean to go meet his wife because she had to suffer the death of their four daughters alone. He's going to meet her, and as he's sailing, so goes the story, that the captain of the ship said, here's the spot where that shipwreck happened. And overwhelmed by emotion, he then sat down and immediately wrote this song. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot thou hast taught me to say, it is well, it is well with my soul.
There are several verses to that song, and one of them is this verse. Though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, let this blessed assurance control, that Christ hath regarded my helpless estate and hath shed his own blood for my soul. It is well with my soul. Though trials should come, though Satan buffets, though there are terrible things in this world, God's in the business of redeeming things. He poured out his blood because he cares about things on this earth. He will not let them all go by the wayside. He does care about evil. He does care about justice. He does have it handled. Evil has a death sentence pronounced on its head. And God says, just wait and live by faith. He will take care of it. Don't give up on that faith.